the Almost Perfect Podcast.
Welcome to the Almost Perfect Podcast, a celebration of fuck-ups, failures, and falling flat on your face. This is a podcast that believes you can learn from experience, but that experience doesn't have to be your own. Ha, I'm Bob Perfect, and I'm a functional fuck-up. Let's learn from somebody else's mistakes. And today we're learning from Conrad Koch. Now, Conrad is a comedian and a ventriloquist. And if you don't know who he is, you probably know who one of his puppets is. He is the man who has his hand up the ass of one Mr. Chester Missing. So if you know Chester Missing, you know the work of Conrad. And Conrad has obviously got other characters as well. If you've ever gone and watched his live show, you know that he's got a variety of personalities. And as you'll see in this podcast, he's got a broad scope in general. So this is quite a fun chat. It's quite a deep chat. Conrad does have, I think he says, his master's in anthropology, which is something that, has interested him forever and allows him to take a pretty different look, or at least a bit of a deeper look, at both himself and other people, which gives his comedy its unique edge, I guess. So yeah, we obviously also get into the controversies. I don't avoid that. We chat about Chester's identity crisis over the course of his lifespan, how he was blackface at one time, essentially, and the process of figuring all of that out and dealing with the backlash, and also moving past it and figuring out how to move forward with the character, and just, you know, as a performer, and in general, just how Conrad deals with a lot of backlash from a lot of different kinds of people. It's a pretty broad spectrum that gives him criticism, which I guess some people would say means you're doing something right. He also does get, obviously, a hell of a lot of love, and so does Chester. And so, yeah, man, we get into a lot of interesting topics on this podcast. I think you're really going to dig it. I need to let you know that this podcast is brought to you by you. That means it's brought to you by patreon.com/almostperfect. You can go there and subscribe to the Patreon for as little as $1 a month. That's right, just $1. And guess what? You do that, I'll send you some stickers in the post. No matter where in the world you are. Obviously, like, it might take a while with, you know, Coco beware up in the jaw. But yeah, I will send you stickers. I don't know if you'll get them, but if you subscribe to the Almost Perfect Patreon, that is what will happen. There are other benefits too. If you start going higher up, you can also do a bunch of things. But I suggest you just go to the link. Just do that, and then you'll see it tells you. Because I don't have it in front of me, so I wasn't planning on doing an ad read here. I just went with it, because that's what I was feeling at the time, you know? What are you feeling? How are you doing? I hope you're okay. Me? Yeah, man. Yeah. Just, it's been a week. Nothing has fucking happened. Like, you know, I haven't really gone anywhere other than to the fucking shops with my gran. But that's, still, somehow, it's managed to just be this, like, overwhelming, overbearing, just, fucking well of sadness, I guess. But I guess it's, like, my gran's having a hard time, and as some of you might know, I'm living with my gran at the moment because my grandfather passed away on New Year's Eve, and yeah, she's in a two-bedroom house at the moment until the estate gets settled up and all those things. So I'm staying here, but she's getting a bit depper, and I'm, you know, getting a bit depper because she's getting a bit depper. So it's been a bit sad up in here lately. But I know I'll get through it. I'm just worried about her, you know? I just want to make sure that she's okay. And that's, yeah, that's been an interesting change in your, like, it's also my birthday is coming up this Sunday. And I'm just not feeling it at all, man, because this last year has just, like, there's nothing to fucking celebrate. Like, why party, man? I can't even party. There's nothing I can do. I'm so used to also just doing some ostentatious fucking bullshit for my birthday, you know, whether it's like some big party or like a roast. I mean, I've had fucking Phantasma, which was Book Matumbo's band, playing my birthday party. I've had Moonchild playing my fucking birthday party. I've had like every band in Durban that's like good play my birthday party. So yeah, it's I know it's so selfish and so self-involved to think about these dumb things like at this time, but at the same time it is. It's just like I just like feel this last year has taken fucking everything. It hasn't taken everything from me, I know that. I've still got a lot, but it's taken a fucking lot, and I know it's taken a lot from a lot of you as well, and I know I can't get so myopic and so in my own head with things, but at the same time, it's like, it is just a lot, and just the fucking monotony, and just, I miss Nass, and like, you know, we were working on a lot of things together, we were writing, like, well, we were pitching ideas to each other, essentially, we were workshopping ideas to write movies together this year, and also it was just someone that I spoke to like a hell of a lot last year, and now like I don't have that person to talk to, and it's been difficult, man. So yeah, I'm just in a bit of a weird space, but I'm keeping on keeping on, you know the saying, we move, and so that's what I'm trying to do. Yeah, so I hope you're alright, like I genuinely do. I know some of you listening to this probably aren't, and hey, at least you know you're not the only one, hey? what else I gotta tell you, man? Let's go to the Patreon stuff once again. If you sign up to the Patreon, there is a tier, it's called the Titular Titles tier, and also a $10 tier. But at this tier, you're allowed to pick your title, hence the Titular Titles tier. You get to write whatever you want me to say, whatever you want to call me. If you want me to say you're a cunt, I can do that. If you want me to say you're the raddest dude in the world, I can say that. Like, whatever it is, just give me $10, and within reason, or within taste, as I said last time, I will do that for you. So, shout out to the Chief Sales Officer of Subtle Heresies in the Greater Oberberg Region, Rousseau. Shout outs to King Julian. Shout outs to Stephen Olafbeer, who is the executive producer. Shout outs to my spiritual advisor, who is Vishendra Naidu. Shout outs to Tyron Love, who is the pantsless weasel. And you know what? A special shout out to you. Yes, you, for listening to this podcast today. I appreciate it immensely. If you want to support it and you don't want to throw in like any cash, that's totally chilled. Please just go rate, review, subscribe, all those things. Social media, just put Almost Perfect Podcast, Almost Perfect Media into your browsers, into your apps, and something will come up. Like you'll find it. Click the things that do the things, and let's be a thing together. Also, we do have mugs. They are 100 Rand. They've got the Almost Perfect logo on them, and they were printed by the Print Room Durban. You should go check them out. Same as our stickers. They give us a little discount for saying that, so shout outs to them. Much appreciated. And yeah, the mugs are 100 Rand each, with 100 Rand for delivery. 10 Rand from each sale goes to Sasonke. Sasonke is an organization that is working to decriminalize sex work in South Africa. And yeah, it's by sex workers, for sex workers. And I recommend you go check out their website, sasonke.org.za, for more information on them. Lastly, I need to let you know that this Sunday, the competition for the Lilies Are Red 7-inch clear vinyl closes. So yes, midnight on my birthday, I will be giving one of you the Lilies Are Red 7-inch. Now, this is a cool collaboration between We Are Lilies and Roses Are Red, which are two independent record labels here in South Africa. They're doing a bunch of dope collaborations, essentially. They're going to be putting out a bunch of 7-inch vinyls that have singles on them by two different artists, and or maybe even more, but two different songs, essentially. So I've got a copy of the first one. I'm going to be giving that to one of you. So all you have to do to win that is email me or hit me up on social media. So my email is bob@almostperfect.co.za. And the social media is almostperfectza on Twitter. It's almostperfectmedia on Facebook and almostperfectmedia on Instagram. So yeah, hit me up on any post really, or just bob@almostperfect.co.za, and tell me what your favorite takeaway or your most pertinent takeaway, your biggest takeaway, the thing that stood out the most from the Rose Boniker episode of this podcast. And yeah, motivate your answer a little bit. If I think you got the best answer, if I think you got the best entry, if I think you've motivated your answer the most, then yeah, I will swing you that 7-inch vinyl. And I'll be honest with you, not that many entries yet. So you've got a couple of days, depending on when you're listening to this, to get those entries in, and you've got a pretty high chance of winning. Probabilities are high, depending. If you've already entered, then your probabilities will go down, obviously, the more other people enter. So sorry about that, but personally, for my ego, I'd like the number to go up a bit. So that's it. That's everything I needed to tell you, which means it is now time for the Almost Perfect Podcast with Conrad Koch. So how are you living, Conrad?
I'm living great. Thank you, Bob. It's been such a crazy time for all of us. And so in the light of what we've just gone through as comedians having to adjust our entire world, I'm pretty good, actually.
Yeah, you more than most people seem to have really managed to make this lockdown situation work for you, because a lot of us, when a lockdown hit for the first time, everyone started doing lives. I mean, I even started a thing called Almost Live. There's like episodes on YouTube and stuff, but everyone was going on Instagram, on Facebook, interviewing each other, making shows, doing all these things. And I didn't see you come out with something immediately, but months later, you now have like a proper show that you present to corporates that you can now do pretty much anytime.
Yes. The way I saw this was, first of all, I didn't understand why everyone was interviewing everyone, because everyone was doing it. And so what is the audience actually getting out of it? Plus, I'm a big fan of writing good content. I think you must write, and you can't just, you know, you can improv a little bit, but make sure you do some writing. Which is hard, because you kind of got to do it without testing it. And you can test it a bit, and like, you know, you just open up Facebook, go live. If you've got enough fans, you'll have enough audience, and they'll comment on what's funny. But it's not – you still need to deliver content. You need to talk about a thing. You can't just pat each other on the back and laugh each other's like quirky relationship vibes. So if you do that, you know, if you do that – and I have done that, make sure there's a structure to do it in. So I went – what do corporates want? There's no money in the system. There wasn't money in the system before lockdown. We're already in a technical recession in 2019.
What system are you talking about then?
Economically, in South Africa, there's not a lot of money in corporate coffers to book comics, and that's where we earn most of our money from. So you need to be offering them something that they can justify on their bottom line. So you need to go, what is something that, like, from a business point of view, is justifiable? So, for example, a talk on corporate culture is justifiable. A team building is justifiable. A talk on diversity-related issues – I hate the word diversity because it's used by racists to not deal with the real problem, but that's the word we have. So you need to create a product. So I went in – and that was very obvious to me the moment this went down. So I went, what can I create that really does this, and how do I get there? And then we went through all the tech hurdles, and I worked with two close mates of mine, Stuart and Grant, here in Cape Town, to build up, hours on Zoom working out how do we create great products for corporates virtually. And then how do I do that? How do I translate what I already have? And I have this racism show that deals with race issues, which I never ever thought I would do virtual. But eventually I was like, it's what I've got. This is where I've put all my eggs. Plus, you know, I've got a master's degree in corporate culture. It's a really wanky thing to tell anybody, but I do. So
I didn't realize that. I know you had the anthropology. I just didn't realize it was in corporate culture.
It is, yeah. But corporate culture is, you know, see, anthropology studies tribes. All I did is treat two banks like they were tribes. Well, I say study tribes is a very bad way of explaining it, terrible way of explaining it. But for us, a layman, we study like a whole community. So you go to like a village and examine what's going on, or you sometimes just study a trait in society. But I went and traded some banks like villages. And so it's corporate culture, but from a sort of anthropology point of view. So yes, that allowed me to jump into the virtual world from a perspective that had an offering for business, was where I started. I've moved a bit forward on that.
Although what I find interesting there is that a lot of South African comedians, and I mean, I'm definitely talking about myself here, hate corporate gigs. Like, just the whole thing is, it can be a bit of a pain depending on who you're doing it for and what they want out of you. You know, you can kind of just be the dancing monkey, and you actually enjoy doing corporates. And I think that might be why, because you actually understand the culture, I guess, and you find it interesting, don't you? You find these people and performing to them to be this enjoyable experience, when the rest of us kind of feel it's a bit of a painful experience. So how did that happen? What intrigues you about it?
It's a great question. It's because it's very problematic in a way doing corporates, because you are getting close to power, and comedy's whole special force is the ability to speak truth to power. And now you're now working for power, so that's sort of selling out. Well, it is not sort of, it is selling out. So,
but it's the only real option in South African comedy when it comes to earning money.
It is, yeah, it is. And this is why it's so difficult doing comedy here, and why it's so satisfying to go, say, for example, to Canada or Australia or the UK, because there's an economy that supports comedy outside of just being a corporate mascot, which is eventually what a lot of us become. And I have a huge problem with that in the South African environment. I enjoy doing it because corporates, South Africa is where a lot of South Africa exists. It's where South Africa mixes the most. It's where black and white and everybody comes together and has to deal with all their crap. And also, we need to understand that South Africa is fundamentally a corporate kind of environment. I mean, the Dutch East India Company was a corporate colonized South Africa, and the British East India Company and the interest in gold mines. I mean, apartheid was literally a scheme to get cheap labor for gold mines. So South Africa's a corporate event in totality. You know, Marikana was, Cyril Ramaphosa, a corporate dude getting the police involved. And, the police were, you know, that's a complicated statement, but it always goes back to money in corporates. And comedians are kind of, you know, Jim Crow in the States, the Jim Crow laws, the racist laws post slavery that were effectively apartheid for, you know, in the States. Those laws were the name Jim Crow was actually a blackface comedy character comedy has always been used by powerful people to reinforce the status quo and to normalize the sort of otherizing of people and genders and normalizing poverty. You know, when we laugh at how car guards are, or how that black guy sounds, as opposed to never laughing at white people sound. So I enjoy corporates because
they need help.
People with the drug, they need help. No, exactly. Normalizing a status quo. So to answer your question, I enjoy doing South African corporates because it's where you can play with those dynamics. I've also got used to what works, but whenever I'm doing them, I'm frustrated by not saying what I'm really thinking and not being able to do what I really would like to be doing. So I'm biding my time. I'm just rather biding my time joyfully than biding my time miserably. But the fact is, I'd rather be doing what I – speaking my truth. And I do that occasionally, like with this racism show, but I have to balance it thoroughly.
Okay, so what is this racism show? You've mentioned it a few times. What's the deal?
I'm going on. Well, for years I sort of dealt with race here and there. And now what I've done is done a show that entirely takes the gloves off and goes right for the central issue, in many ways in the South African conversation. So I struggle to get a way to speak about what's in my head. I mean, when you've actually, again, such a wanker to tell everyone what you've studied, but when you've got a master's degree in anthropology, you have some thoughts on race that are quite complex sometimes.
Some people might disagree with that statement when it comes to you, but we'll get into that just now. True.
Totally, of course, yeah. But to deal with those dynamics, How to explain them in comedy. There are not a lot of environments where you can do that. So it's hard to find an audience that will go with you on quite such complex a journey. So you have to kind of do an arts festival for that. So I committed to doing a show that has less easy commercial value, that examines my own privilege as a white South African and why I am who I am and how I got here. Because I found that the only way to actually get the conversation relatable was, instead of talking about race, other people's racism, was to talk about my own racism and then pull English speaking in particular, middle class in particular, whites in particular, you know, South Africans into the conversation. So I've got a show that does that. It's quite powerful.
What were you saying? Well, what would you say you were doing before that then? Because that's always kind of been my reading of at least the Chester Missing, Conrad Koch conversation side of your comedy. So how has it evolved?
No, I'm not saying it wasn't there. Okay.
Yeah.
Great question. Well, it's evolved in that I working out what I can say and how do I say it, so the technical dynamics of it, and then also the constant tension to be entertaining. I mean, we live in an environment where just doing a show and a kind of Hannah Gadsby's my kind of comedy hero in a particular in some respects, and you know, she just speaks so clearly true to what she has to say, but she can do it because she's living in a very wealthy environment where there are enough people who will listen to such liberal kind of dynamics. In South Africa, my fans are poor. My fans live in shacks. So I need to, and they love this, you know, when I really climb into the issue, but to find a part of Cape Town, for example, where I can do this show, you can't do it at the comedy club in the waterfront. You have to go do it somewhere where more people who relate to the points you're making about race, or you have to get an environment where enough white people who are open-minded are willing to listen. So to get to the point that I'm willing to put money into a show, put time into a show and create a show that can only happen in certain environments took a while.
But I say it can only happen in certain environments. What do you mean by that?
Well, you can't do some of the material I'm doing in this racism show in the Cape Town Comedy Club or at your standard corporate event, because it's just too on the money.
Oh, is it? So what? Like what would happen if you did? Because, you know, as you say, isn't comedy meant to be like speaking truth to power and finding new spaces to bring these ideas into? Like if you look at all the comedians like the greats, you know, Richard Pryor and all of those guys, they, you know, would challenge the really tough topics in comedy clubs and find ways to do it. But at the same time, they would piss a hell of a lot of people off. So what's the balance issue that you're facing there?
We don't live in the United States where they've got 300 million people. So even a fraction of open-minded people is a very large group of people. We live in a country with a tiny middle class with very little money. So that fraction of people who are open-minded enough to have their boundaries pushed is much smaller. So we have to, in many ways, compromise, unfortunately, in order to even survive. And it's sort of quite a layered conversation for me because on one hand, like the Richard Pryor kind of thing or a very alternative comedy in the UK, like a Stuart Lee.
Yeah, I love
that
Stuart
content,
Lee.
Yeah, that content is a product of wealth. I mean, the Edinburgh Festival can happen in the UK as this incredible liberal arts, like such a rare comedy, can only happen because they colonized half the world and have the money to have people who can afford to go watch such shows. South Africa doesn't have that privilege. So that doing that that incredibly aware work is actually very privileged. We have to be able to survive at a tractor convention, explaining to apartheid beneficiaries and getting them to understand. And to do that, you do have to charm them. You can't just go in guns blazing to a group of people who are quite conservative and say, you benefited from a system, an atrocious system of racial supremacy, and are still benefiting and nothing has changed. You can do it, but you don't get anyone to listen.
Yeah, you would Bill Hicks it up essentially there.
Exactly.
Because he would go into crowds and just swear at them and just call them stupid and just like talk down to them.
It's great.
And
yeah,
his career, it's wonderful to watch. But like, and it's, as a comedian, it's like, oh, I wish I could fucking do that. But it's when you're actually on stage and you're staring at the audience and you know that like, well, I need to make a paycheck out of this, it's a lot different.
Yeah, and that's the exact what the compromise you're sitting on there is, the uncomfortable truth of South Africa. There's no way to avoid not benefiting from apartheid as a white South African, and that fact never goes away in any conversation you ever have.
Yep, that is 100% true, unfortunately. But when did you first start figuring that out?
Oh, that took a long time to understand in depth. Eh? Yeah, when I studied the stuff and I met, you know, I went to Bishop's, but I was like a kind of fringe kid in that environment, so I didn't feel included. But that doesn't mean I didn't get all the advantages. But I didn't feel like I don't identify with those dudes.
Yeah, relatable. So,
but it was not like it's not like anyone was coming and going, do you understand what apartheid is? This is what happened. And even when I met Truth and Reconciliation commissioners when I was, you know, in my like undergrad vibes and met people who were tortured by the apartheid state, they still don't explain the granular detail of how the little advantages exist in accent, in culture, in social capital, in cultural capital. So it took years. I mean, my master's degree really helped me build that idea, the understanding of the South African comedy industry into what's acceptable. I mean, Chester being brown at all, if I'd lived in the UK, I would have had more awareness of the dynamics of that. At the same time, I live in Africa, so the conversation was complex. I mean, we don't live in the UK. So a brown puppet, it's just, you know, not right or wrong. That's what I was asking myself.
Okay, well, that's the thing. What were you thinking about when you came up with Chester being brown, being colored? Because nowadays it's considered by many people to be blackface and you've gotten a ton of criticism for it. But knowing you and knowing your history and knowing all the work you've put in, obviously you're anti-racist and yet you created something that many consider to be racist. So what were your thoughts going into it? Like, were you considering these things? Were you thinking like, is this blackface? Or were you not actually on that level of the conversation yet?
I suppose the simple answer is I wasn't on that level of the conversation yet. But in terms of how the conversation happened, the concept that it could be blackface, it never really hit me because we were doing the shows for people of color mostly. My fans were more, you know, that was clearly.
I mean, Leon Schuster's biggest fans are people of color. So,
no, that's true. That's true. But the jokes were not like when you watch a comedy show, which is blackface, and make no mistake, Chester's white now for exactly this reason. So I'm just trying to sort of explain what my thinking was and how I ended up where I am now. Is it when you do blackfacey blackface, if there's such a thing, you hyperbolize accent. So in other words, you hyperbolize how the black character says the word stupid. You hyperbolize the eshes, the yo masa, what's. You hyperbolize the ahwes. So the audience, you can hear the audience, it's very clear. The audience laughs at the accent. The joke is not the joke. The identity is the joke. Now, there was a time where Chester did do those things. Chester had a thing where he used to say, that is a very old version of Chester from 2002. That completely.
Oh, wow. But there was. I didn't realize he was that old.
No, sexist. No. But that version of him was like a rugby ball, like puppets that. You know, working it out. The puppets did nail white people hard, but it also did this blackface, you know, stuff. But always like aware, like what's the right way to do this? I also had a Scottish puppet, which is the same sort of conversation. I do have Scottish ancestry, but do I have a right to have a,
I've been thinking about that a lot lately, just the power dynamics of accents. Because, I mean, we know like certain types of accents in South Africa you definitely shouldn't do as a white person. But then is it okay to mock entire nations based on stereotypes? And that is like, even, you know, if they are a wealthy nation like Australia, you know, like people constantly make fun of the way British people talk. And like, obviously, they've got a lot of power. So is that just speaking back to power or are there actual issues behind that?
Good question. I think the only dynamic that happens is that the racists have literally had this conversation with someone who goes, oh, well, you know, I can make a white person, often from Durban when they want to make Indian accents, making a stereotype Indian accent at a Pariah once. And I was like, no, that's just stop. Or perceived Indian accent, because, of course, Indian people have as many accents as they're Indian people.
But the,
yeah. Exactly. But the stereotypes at Indian accents, and then the then I go, this is problematic. She goes, I have Irish descent. So people make Irish accents. I said, well, if an English person makes an Irish accent demeaningly, yes, that's got a historical problem, but it's not the same because, there's not, the Irish life expectancy and living conditions and historical and place within sort of the economic situation globally is incomparable compared to Africa's, and that's a direct what went with that was a history of colonialism and how accents and culture and evolution, they did simple social Darwinism that they saw anything that sounded African as less evolved, and that's what you're laughing at when you do, and the accent's the joke. So Chester, then when he became the sort of the dude that you knew on late night news, his accent wasn't the joke in my mind. I mean, maybe there were people who were racist laughing his accent, but you could hear the audience is laughing at the joke the dude said, which made me as a white person sort of objectified and nailed my position. That doesn't mean it's okay, but the fact is that's just not what Leon Schuster, I'm not doing what Leon Schuster was doing in that situation, because clearly to me, whether that's okay or not okay is, of course, eventually, a white dude creating a dude of color sort of signifies to any white people that it's okay, which is clearly that it's not okay. Plus, it's sort of my wife is an actor of color. She's identifies as colored. The opportunity she doesn't get because white people can play Latino roles when she goes for castings, but she can never go get any of the white roles. So it only goes, it doesn't go both ways. So by having a character of color, just conceptually, it sort of occupies a space where, that is profoundly unfair. So for that, I feel there's a lot of problematic stuff with Chester. The fact that he was like a joking character and had any kind of identifiable accent that we identified as colored reinforced the kind of perception of what a colored person is. And that's just fucking problematic. So for me, those were the serious problems with Chester.
Well, yeah, that's the thing, because you might even be trying to create a character that's a positive representation, but that's still a stereotype. Well, it still becomes stereotyped through the work that you're creating. And nowadays, how would you see Chester? How has he evolved?
Well, I mean, he's become sort of an extension of me, which he always was an extension of me, of course, because he's me, but like literally. But he's become... He's become this dude who speaks truth to power in all sorts of forms and just my mate. This was a very hard thing for me. You see, as a puppet of like when he was brown, in order to exist, he had to nail me very hard. And so it became very difficult for white audiences to watch my shows at all because he was brutal. It couldn't be friendly and jovial. So the relationship was difficult. Unless you were actually fully on board with the politics, it was hard for people to watch versus the stuff I'd like what I toured Canada with my show Puppet Guy. It was a lot more fun than silly because he's a white puppet, I'm a white guy, and we're just having fun. And sometimes it'll get very political, and sometimes it's about cheese and cricket. I needed to do that in order to survive because I'm a comedian, man. You see how serious I sound right now. I'm a comedian, but I sound like such a freaking academic. So I need to tone it back and have a little bit of fun and just some silliness, take myself a bit less seriously, and created a DJ puppet out of a hoodie and just pandemonium. Now I'll go back into race, and then next I'll go do some silly stuff again just because I've got to, like you say, Bob, we've got to stay sane.
Well, yeah, I mean, I remember when we hung out a couple years ago, it was with Kahiso, and I think we landed up drinking on Florida Road for the night, and we were talking about just everything. And I remember you being like, I'm kind of over, Chester being the main thing. I want these other characters and these other sides of me to actually get out there and to be able to explore these other issues. So that's why I found it interesting that you've gone back into the race thing. So is this going to be a cyclical thing for you?
Yeah, it is how it seems like it's going to be. Because it's sort of what happens is you take a break, you breathe, and then you remember, I've got some things to say. And because you've had some chance to recover and work out what your thoughts were, then you realize, this is what I need to say, is the one thing. The second thing is having toured Australia and Canada and done some time in the UK, is that the conversation Chester has with me on race is powerful. The post-colonial conversation is something that South Africa is extremely good at, and I'm quite good at doing that within the South African context. So it's something I can do, and I think it is something that I enjoy doing in an environment where the audience gets it. So, for example, I did a show at the Bill Murray Comedy Club open mic kind of spot in London just before this COVID hit. And it was like incredible. I lost my voice. I was a bit sick. Luckily,
that is not good for a ventriloquist, from what I understand.
No, this was funny. It was really funny because I had the same voice as Chester. It was terrible. And then Chester was like, and I was like, and then Chester's joke was, the white guy lost his voice. Now that's a revolution. And the comedy club exploded because they got the political context and stuff. And, you know, it's great to find a large audience that will go with you as you explore those kind of questions. In South Africa, it's harder to find that audience that they can afford to pay.
You've brought that up a few times, and it's something I've also thought about a hell of a lot, is just like, you know, South African comedy audiences aren't there. Like, it's such a strange thing to try and actually do. I mean, there are the comedians who can just do, I wouldn't say generic, but like somewhat palatable to everyone kind of comedy, you know, and they do just fine because they can get up in front of most crowds, and most crowds kind of just want that kind of comedy, like the Kevin Hart kind of stuff, you know. Whereas if you actually want to discuss issues in your comedy, which is what some people do, like yourself and like a few others, I find it does get, you know, harder to actually have a career in comedy in South Africa. Obviously, you've got the likes of Luisa Gola, who has just made it his whole thing, but he's also someone who's had to look overseas to try and find a bigger audience almost. So is that also the problem that you're facing?
Yes. I mean, it's literally Loy and I on the same career path. We have the same London management. But that being said, we have great South African audiences, and South African audiences, the right South African audiences, are incredibly aware politically. I mean, your average white South African even is more aware of race issues than most white Canadians, because they just know more people of color. Even if they're outright racist, they just know more about like what a black existence is. You know, the dynamics.
I mean, many racists, I know, no Zulu. So, like.
Well, exactly. So, the difficult thing comes, as you say, is when it gets, you really want to climb into a little bit slightly more serious style of comedy. But if you're going to do playful, fun stuff, there's an audience. And that's why I do corporate work and I enjoy it. And I have theater shows where I've sold out weeks at Monte Cassino in Joburg and at the Baxter here, where, you know, people come and it's just fun jokes about Helen Ziller and the drought and etc. So it just means having two levels to yourself. It means you have to give the publicly accessible, easy fun, and then I want to be a little bit more, let me chase that sort of, Bill Hicks energy, that Dave Chappelle energy. Not to say I have any of that, anything close to that talent, but, you know, we can try.
Yeah, no, that's my eternal struggle is I think my comedy career started to take off a couple of years back when I was doing a bunch of stuff that I hated doing. Like, you know, like, because I learned, like, hey, you can't be the super atheist comic in South Africa. Like, that's just not going to work out for you. Mm-mm. And so I started.
Ricky Gervais
also,
would not happen.
No. And also, I mean, I just got over just being that dude. But as I got more towards the comedy I wanted to do, I found I lost the audience almost. It was like I could choose to do the thing that I know works and gets everyone on board, but I'm just going to hate myself like every night that I do this. That was why like I quit comedy for like 2 or 3 years back in the day. And now I just do my own thing. And like, I'm not even really trying to have a South African comedy career, you know, like I just do stand up comedy and whatever happens with it happens with it. But yeah, I don't really know where I was going with that. So what we're going to do is actually, I usually chat to people about all this stuff towards the end and start with, hey, how, you know, did you grow up? So how did you grow up, Conrad? Where did you grow up? What schools did you go to? And yeah, what was childhood like for you?
Bob, I'm from Cape Town, of course, and I went to the southern suburbs type English vibes. I went to a little school called Golden Grove. I went to a Jewish nursery school, which is quite entertaining. So it was always like the stars of the Sabbath on Fridays and the food and all that. And then I don't know why I went to a Jewish nursery school. It was just nearby. And for some reason, it was like a mixed race Jewish nursery school. So I had like, there's like kids of all races there. It was kind of a weird place.
That was only in South Africa
at the time in the 80s in Cape Town. It's so strange. Wow. Awesome, but strange. And then I went to, you know, just southern suburb schools, Rondebosch boys prep, and ended up at Bishop's. And I started doing magic as a hobby, and magic is really fun because I was a bit of a weird kid.
Definitely struck me as the type.
That's so creepy, dude. You know, I play with puppets still. There's nothing's changed.
I mean, I used to go to clubs with a deck of cards and perform card tricks. I used to wear a blazer.
See? That's what I'm saying.
We recognize our own,
well,
you know?
The best. You know, team creepy. And then I was strongly in team creepy. Still am. And I really enjoyed that. But I enjoyed ventriloquism because of the social contract, sort of the, it's not me, it's a little guy. I make the prefect talk in the queue, and then, you know, in the line at school is the dream. And
so, then that's so not did you start practicing back then?
Yeah, I started ventriloquism when I was like a little kid, like 10. I mean, I was terrible.
How do you get started? Like what, because also, I mean, like, I have no fucking clue how it works. Like it is a magic trick in its own right, you know? So like as a kid, what are you thinking? You're like, do you find books on it or do you just start practicing with like trying to talk with your mouth closed?
Well, we all have an imaginary idea of what a ventriloquist, we all have an exposure to ventriloquist of some sort. So right now, most people would have seen like Jeff Dunham or someone on one of the America's Got Talent shows. And so that's their idea of what a ventriloquist is. And they aspire to that. Then you start doing it and you start, oh, that's not really what it is. I remember seeing a ventriloquist called Ron Lucas, who I actually met in Vegas once. Very nice guy. He's got a little cowboy character. You saw Ronald Reagan. And in the show, Ronald Reagan was in the audience, and Ronald Reagan was sitting with, I think it's Nancy Reagan, isn't it? She was sitting in the front, and then he went, oh, look, it's the leader of the puppet. This is the joke. The puppet went, oh, look, it's the leader of the free world, and she bought her husband. So, so you know, a silly little joke. And that just the dynamic of that, and this puppet was so cheeky at this president, and it just seemed like a really fun kind of energy. That really sold me on it, and that just that joke and that dynamic influenced me a lot. So then growing up, you know, I like the idea of just focusing on one thing. You know, I think that that's an important choice to make, is don't try to be everything to everyone. Get something you're good at and chase that. And so I stayed with the ventriloquism. So when stand-up kind of started, you know, I also like stand-up in the 90s. We were all at university at the same time. So sort of Riyad Moussa, Kagiso, David Kao, Stuart Taylor, me, Tsepo Mogale. And you had UCT, and kind of like comedy kind of started, and we started getting comedy stages, and so ventriloquism just sort of made sense, you know.
How did that whole crew come together? How did you come to be involved with them?
Well, it was just fortuitous that, you know, with 94, and then it's kind of 96, I think, we started there at UCT. There was room for comedy. Like the question of like mixed race kind of interesting rooms, it was like a thing that could happen. But there was no history. Remember, the UK has had decades to work itself out. It had that whole movement of amazing alternative comedy that happened in the 80s, which is where like a Stuart Lee comes from, where a Joe Brand comes from.
There was free education for the arts.
Exactly.
They
actually
allowed to flourish.
And so, exactly. So they had this kind of grammar, this kind of history to work with that gave them a place to move towards. They understood the story they were in versus us. Well, we didn't really have a lot. I mean, we had, for me, the white kid in Rondebosch, it kind of Peter de Gase.
Oh,
it was really, I mean, Peter de Gase was the, in my very conservative little world, all I had almost. And so that idea of politicians and satire really shaped what I thought I was doing, and comedy, you know, that was around us. And so when we started hanging out, we had the Cape Comedy Collective. And so there were some Brits who were living here, Sam Pierce and Mark Sampson, great people, started the Cape Comedy Collective with a group of us. And then Kagiso was around, Dave Carr was around, Riyad was around, Stuart Taylor was around. And we all kind of started mid-90s, jumping on stage at Barney's downstairs in Cape Town, trying out.
What were those
what's
gigs
the angle.
Like? Were there any good? Were you guys like looking
They were probably
back?
Terrible. They were probably terrible. I mean, I don't know. Fuck it. They probably were atrocious, but they were fun because it was like, you know, it was sort of like Cool Runnings type of feeling, but we're all cuck, so there's no one to remind us how good looks versus later we started, oh, that's how good looks. Okay, we need to get better.
That's a, like, I kind of feel like some of your era of comedy are very lucky that there wasn't anyone before them. Like, I'm not going to name names or anything, but I do like think that there were a few people who were carried.
Got into it.
Like, they were like carried by other people who are a lot more talented than them, you know, yeah. But because they were around when it started, they've got this legacy behind them now.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's just a personal little feeling towards some people. Although I actually did want to ask you, do you ever worry about, you know, the youngsters taking over? Because comedy has evolved so much since you started. I mean, I didn't even realize it was that far back, but I know you've been in the game for a long time. And yeah, I found it really interesting to see that your career has probably only really taken off in the last like 10 years or so through LNN, through everything else, but you've been on the ground for such a long time. So are you worried like that now that you're there, that there's all these other talented people, or is because you're in quite a niche that you don't really need to worry about that? And also you've created these characters, or at least with Chester, that is nationally known. So I don't know, you probably don't have those worries, do you?
No, we all have fears of like not being relevant, of not being good enough, not being talented enough, not getting the gap that you need in sync with what, how your life's working, you know, COVID lockdown. It was meant to be in Edinburgh last year. It's meant to be in Edinburgh this year now. So, you know, and what if it's too late or those things? Of course, everyone has those fears. But from a comedy point of view, see, ventriloquism has a problem in that the devices we use are very hard to get made and very expensive. So sure. I had been inspired by a ventriloquist called, David Strassman, who's got this amazing show where his puppets are all like a robotic. And he came to South Africa in the early 2000s. At the end of his show, all his puppets come to life with robotic things. And so there wasn't really a model of how do you become, what do you do? What's the game plan here? So I knew I needed money. And so what I decided to do, and it was this clear choice, Stuart Taylor and I had, that this Stuart is going to do public shows. I was going to go to do corporates, go to Joburg and do a lot of corporates to get enough money to be able to try what I need to try, which I did do. I went to, and that's when, I found as I was doing this, and so I was doing well enough doing sort of kind of corporate comedy, did the 5FM comedy jams and Blacks Only back in the day. So I wasn't not there. I just wasn't getting TV exposures, you know, which as you say, I hadn't popped in any kind of way. I just was doing fine. I was making a good living out of comedy. I bought a home. Chester did, was an old version of Chester, used to grill the CEO of SAA for like every month for like 2 years. So kind of doing what he did on TV eventually, but more just about issues within the company. So I was very good at that, but not any national exposure sort of thing, because it's kind of a hard thing to put on a platform. What do you do that everyone's going to notice as a ventriloquist? Like Jeff Dunham got a dead Muslim and that popped his career. What do you do sort of thing? So Chester speaking truth to power and politicians and doing good political content found a place on Late Night News. Does that mean that there's a movement of the younger cats will move forward? Well, the truth is, if you just stay unique and stay on your game, there's always some way for you. You just got to stay in your lane. So, I mean, Trevor started doing comedy when I was doing my master's. Like, I'd never really hung out with Trevor in his early days because I was really kind of off the club circuit because I was busy focusing on studying and stuff. Then he sort of popped. So suddenly this dude's hosting The Daily Show. And so you've got to check your ego.
It took
your
a few years between that.
Yeah, but I mean, from my perspective, that's quite quick. So remember, I've been doing comedy since mid-90s. Yeah, no, it's great. I'm inspired and love his work. Yeah, I did have a plan. But how do you do what I do and get it to be something that's a globally understandable thing? And I've got my game plan, and I'm just step-by-step doing multiple ways of getting there.
Sorry, I was going to say, would you say that's evolved over the years by seeing guys like Trevor, by seeing guys like Louisa take off, by seeing all these other comedians around you like start to really get global recognition and start to really, you know, do big things? Did that light a fire under you?
The fire was always there. It was never not there. It's just how to do it. The how to do it was not always clear. But actually, let me take that back. Yes, Trevor going and Loy going gave me an idea of a path. Going,
sure.
How do they understand us? and going, I see how they understand us. The other problem is just being a white South African is a very weird thing in the world because, like, what are you? So when you jump on stage in like Montreal, I did the Just for Laughs Comedy Festival, and they're like trying to get that joke that explains this is what I am to the audience. It's quite hard if like because it's such a weird thing. You're a white dude from Africa. Some of the audience will know about apartheid. The younger audience will be a bit like vague on the details. Working that out has taken me a while. Plus, because my stuff is so politically contextual, it's been hard to crack through the being as good overseas as I am here. If I could just do as strong as I am at a Blacks Only in London, I'd clean up. But to get to the point, so you have to spend enough time there to do that. And so how to do that has taken me a while to work out. But I'm solidly on that track, except for fucking COVID.
Yeah, I had a one-man show called The End of the World that I literally performed once. And
we've been in lockdown. That's brilliant.
Yeah, it's a little frustrating considering I was like this thing that I was like, you know, you're finally there, you can do this, you can tour it, you can, you know, get some money together, film it, do whatever. And then like just the whole thing fell apart. And I'm someone who, unlike you, didn't necessarily bounce back that well during the thing. Yeah, I just decided to take my writing the other way. Like I've just been going the screenwriting route. But you actually have two Emmy nominations for writing essentially through the team of LNN. How did you get picked up by the LNN team? How did that all come together?
Well, of course, Kags, you know, and I have known each other forever, and Loy as well. So they actually, on the second show of Late Night News, Loy interviewed Jimmy Mani, you know, ANC and now, what are they called, ATM, a politician. And it was a bit dry. Like it was Loy's second show or whatever. So Kags phoned me up and knew I had a lot of strong political content and said, just come bring Chester to mess around. And when I got there, Chester had to kind of interact with Loy. And it was like, it's going to be clumsy if I'm also in the shot. So suddenly Chester went into being a kind of Muppet, like a more like a puppet situation as opposed to ventriloquism on his own on camera with Loy. And that just popped. People dug it. Like a Twitter went crazy. They really loved it. So we just tried different angles of that. And eventually we're like, why don't we ask a politician? And I got hold of Musi Maimane from the DA, and he was the spokesperson at the time. And the rest is history.
What is it like interviewing politicians when I'm sure you must have some real resentment towards some of them?
It's something I have a conflicted relationship with because, you know, you don't want to get too close to politicians because then you're going to probably give them a break. It's going to get like you probably want to be as stern as you would. And so it's something I still sits with a bit of tension around. I'm not really sure if there is a way around it. For example, Chester got given ties by Mulusi Gigaba for Christmas once. like little tires. So technically
That's
captured.
Controversial.
I think he said it, and you know, it's just that he's a puppet. You didn't know he was a puppet. he's very honest about his puppetness. He's captured. He lives in a suitcase. It doesn't get more captured. But where it gets difficult is sort of when it's sort of like a DA politician who is just full of it about race. And you're like, there's no way for me to give you a break because we're beneficiaries of an evil system that hasn't been resolved. And now it's difficult to make jovial, you know. And then on the other side, you'll interview someone's from the EFF. I remember one, I can't remember who it was, but from my TV show in 2019 interviewed an EFF lady who was just was a bit difficult because there wasn't this air of fun about it. And it's difficult then as a white dude to introduce an air of fun when there are very serious issues going on. So it sort of becomes what's okay and not okay. It's something I sort of grapple with. So there's a lot of
layers to that.
And
it's also the politician laughing at the jokes where you're trying to like roast them and like be like, hey, you did this thing. And then they almost get off the hook by just laughing at it sometimes. Or, I mean, I could imagine that would be something you'd worry about.
You've like jumped in a deep hole. I've got endless theories on this. In anthropology, there's a thing called a ritual of rebellion, which is where you perform a rebellion and it has a cathartic release, but the rebellion never actually happens.
Well, this is the problem
it's sort of seen as problematic. It's exactly the problem with satire. I think the problem with satire in the West, something I'm proud of with Chester is I actually have gone to court with a white supremacist. So I didn't just say it. I actually have put my money where my mouth is on some levels, as pretentious as that is, but I have, and had my family be threatened by the right wing, my street address put online, it's my, you know, my ID put on 8chan on the dark web and stuff. So it's got very real. So it is a problem with satire and a problem I've tried to work against. When I'm standing in front of a group of people and there's a corporate of white dudes and it's almost entirely white audience, I try to make myself say the difficult thing that might make me not be rebooked. I do that a lot. And sometimes it makes me very depressed because I don't want to be that person who says that shit sometimes. I don't always enjoy being me.
Well, I was going to say, does it ever get tiring? That is literally one of the questions that I have here for you is like, does this whole constant political, just being engrossed in it in general, in South African politics, which is fucking depressing and is just painful to deal with because of how you can just, the whole country is just screaming at the TV and screaming at Twitter all day, every day, because it's like, why the fuck are things not working? Why are you still stealing? Why are you still doing this? Like, why? Just why? And you're constantly immersed in it. It's like, it's your fucking job is to know what's happening in politics. So yeah, I was going to ask, does that get tiring?
Well, surprisingly enough, I've recently realized that's actually not my job. In spite of the fact that I act like it's my job.
Okay.
My most of my work in the last 6 months, this virtual work, has been Chester gatecrashing Zoom meetings in his show called Zoom with a View, which is really just lighthearted, Chester joking around with like a couple of managers and the team and doing some light political jokes, but mainly just jokes about who's there and having a fun time and making everyone feel happy and survive in this environment. That's where I've earned most of my money. The racism show has also done well as a virtual show. I've totally transformed it and it's really powerful. Like video comes up and visuals and sound effects and multiple cameras. And we really have fun making it technically amazing. But talking politics doesn't pay. There's no one who goes, we want you to come in and say difficult facts about the South African political status quo. That doesn't happen. So people have this idea, oh, you make money out of saying things about politicians. No, I don't. There's, even having a TV show that does politics pays very little compared to a corporate gig. I get paid less for a month of TV show shoots than I do for one corporate gig. So, and I certainly didn't make myself friends with any corporate people by pissing off the whole right wing and Jacaranda FM's whole audience by going to court with Steve Hoffman. So I like the idea that this is like, so it's contentious because it actually doesn't pay me to be this loudmouth asshole. Most of my money is made being fun and silly with a puppet.
So it's weird because I think you and Deep Fried Man kind of share that in a way because you both face that right wing pushback and it does affect like, you know, the content you then produce from then on out.
Yeah. Right wing's a Deep Fried Man's a strong example. I just have enjoy doing the sort of slightly more accessible, silly commercial stuff enough that it's okay. But I've given myself an outlet by having this great, really fun, but powerful and enjoyable to do show on deeper issues that I can let off steam with that and know that there's a place for that in the world overseas and in festivals and stuff that allows me to be that person while I'm living this kind of middle life of being the sort of quirky puppet guy.
So you'd say you've actually found that balance. So it's not as tiring to, you're not always dealing with politics. You've actually diversified your act into so many different things now that you get to explore all these different sides of yourself. And so none of it is ever too overwhelming.
Well, I'm just quite an intense person. So as you can hear, I always find these kind of chats weird because they're very self-indulgent, but I am quite an intense person. So I need to, my wife is a woman of color. She's gone through her own massive issues in her own life and still does continuously. My worst day is never something I can complain about to her because she has far harder time than I ever have had. So, but the problem is that I can't bring my heaviness into our world all the time because it's something that she grew up with. versus it's just, I'm just a tourist in this conversation. So I found that I need to lower the tone and make myself less central. So for example, I can't stand what the Kiffness is doing. You know, that is
his
racist satire. Yeah, yeah. But I won't go take him on a big public platform and shout and scream about it, because that's just two white guys grabbing center of attention again, which is what my criticism of the Steve Hofmeyr thing would be. So I balance it by not getting too involved and not arguing with the internet trolls. You know, those guys exist there and I exist here, and I'll do what I can, but that's all I can do.
Do you get a lot of that, though, on your replies now, or has that kind of died down, or has it gotten worse over the years?
It depends. It depends on the content I put out. So if I tweet a strongly racially like difficult thing for people about, say, benefiting from apartheid or something, a video that Chester makes or something, that'll get quite a few replies, the sort of Ronaldo host will kick in. But he just seems so little that I just never reply to him. He's just such a, well, you're a DA YouTuber. I don't know why I'm just talking. and then it's ridiculous. It's preposterous. You're a DA counselor as a YouTube channel. Just fuck off. You clown.
I've laughed about that for years.
It's ridiculous. But on my own Twitter account, you know, it's at Conrad Koch. And as, for example, I was promoting the racism show. I gave the proceeds to the Katrada Foundation. I gave a percentage of the proceeds last year and did the virtual version. And the amount of trolling that they – because they try to find an angle. Oh, you had a brown puppet, so you're racist. And going, yeah, but yeah, I've spoken about this. In fact, I had a whole show dealing with it. So what? So they don't – so what they, or they just tell me how talentless they think I am. And it's just relentless to have people tell you how much they hate you so much. So I sort of avoid my own Twitter accounts. And if people do give me shit, I tend to just block them. And I don't tag people. So also, if I argue about Gareth Cliff or something, I don't tag him and I don't go on. I say my piece and then I bounce. I have a show, as Loy would say, Loy is actually the guy I learned this from. We have a platform, so I just do a show on the issue. I don't use Twitter's not where South Africa lives, so I do a show on the issue and I get that show to be seen.
And this is something I've thought so fucking much about as well, is just that whole thing of, why am I wasting time putting content on Twitter, putting the stuff out on Instagram, doing all these things, making these people money, when and getting having stuff misconstrued, when I could actually take some time, think about this, write about it, and yeah, actually create something rather than just tweeting a pithy little thought that then, you know, 50 people tell me I'm a cunt for, and like 10 others are like, oh, you're a champ. And like, I feel good about myself and everything like that, but nothing's happened. Like, that's the problem that I have with social media so much, is like, yeah, there's discourse, and I do think it has helped push discourse forward in a lot of ways, but it's also helped like things regress in so many ways, because it's now become so fucking polarizing. Like, you can't have a nuanced opinion anymore. It's either you are for us or you are against us. And that has become why I have just found myself less and less and less on the internet, because it just makes me so frustrated. And like, that's the thing, I don't get the replies that you get. I mean, I can only imagine, like, well, I mean, I check, you know, Chester's replies sometimes, and it is just people calling you an idiot or this and that. But then how do you balance that, like that whole thing of just constantly being like told you're wrong and you're shit and this and that, versus the actual success that you're having? Like, you know, when you actually do shows and you see people laughing and you know your ticket sales are going up. Because that's the same thing with Loy. Loy gets told he's a shit comedian on Twitter every fucking day. Yet, you know, Loy's selling out in London. So what kind of effect does it have on your psyche?
It makes you depressed. I mean, if you're in the – I mean, of course, it makes you depressed to sort of be this sort of explosive sort of figure. But then you just got to, you kind of get a bit cold, because I sort of manage it. So I treat it like you know, social media is a product and it's part of my product. I mean, I don't always stick to this, but you know, I sort of became a bit callous. And what may be callous, it's problematic, but it's complex, is when I'll get a person of color attacking me for taking on racism in a way that's like really disingenuous. So like, how dare you talk about race in a fun way? You know, it's too serious. And it's like, well, we're actually convincing some people to think about, like, really, man, if I'm going to have right-wing white people, middle white people, the alt-right, and some sort of extreme left person of color, like, where's this meant to happen? Who am I meant to talk to? Go tell white people. If you tried to, they shout at you if you tell them. Who must they? So I sort of became quite cynical and like, okay, Chester Online is a product. You're watching. I will perform it for you. I will tweet material to allow people to engage with them so that when I tweet an ad or a promotional thing, you'll see it and notice it because you got enough content that you enjoyed. And it's pretty brutal. I know that the long term, no one gets paid to tweet in real terms unless you're Kim Kardashian or Max Mopagnani. You get paid to do great comedy. Jeff Dunham popped because for his audience, and I don't like his stuff, but for his audience, he was really good. So just create really good shit. Go create that show that will become the next biggest watch thing on Netflix. Create work, okay, which is what you're busy doing. So I love that.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to do. But then the whole conversation of access comes up. And then also, like, the funniest thing is I saw the other day on Twitter, this one dude like being like, if you write 2 pages a day by the end of the year, you'll have all of this. I'm like, cool, but do you have an agent? Do you have a producer? Do you have all these other things that now come into the whole thing when it comes to these things? And for you, you were saying you've actually got London managements now. So how's your career in terms of that side of things evolved? Like, because when you started out, I'm sure it was all open mics with friends, like, and that steadily built into a career. When did you start getting agents, and how do you decide who to work with when it comes to that side of things?
That's a good question. So in South Africa, we don't really have management. They'll tell you they're management, but they're not management. So we have people who will take a percentage of your money for answering the phone, which is just crazy because you don't really need someone to do that for you. You really can just answer a couple of emails or just get a PA. If you have enough shows to need an agent, you can afford a PA. So just get a PA. I don't have a PA. I'm fine with just answering the emails for gigs. And when it's busy, then I spend some time doing that. When it's not, I don't have anyone I have to give money to because you literally are giving like thousands of rands a show for nothing. So I did have management. And plus in South Africa, it's the relationship you have with people. So my relationship with you, my relationship with different comedian people, my relationship with journalists, my relationship with people in the political world, my relationship with TV people is all personal rapport. People like what I do and we get along and blah, blah, blah. If you have someone in the middle, they're selling themselves and their business and your business. I mean, they might put you forward, but they also might not. So the key is know who's getting the benefit. Make sure you build up rapport with the clients. Don't sit waiting on the back foot for that to happen. And then with London, you know, that took everything I've got. I literally went overseas to Canada and to Australia over and over again trying to get material so that I had video footage of me doing well enough and reviews from arts festivals, multiple 5-star reviews from arts festivals so that I could approach the right person and say, here's evidence I'm good enough. And that person went, that's good evidence. And then they sort of see you at work and they go, wow, you really are worth it. I really believe in what you're doing. And then a couple of weeks ago, I was in a live stream with Eddie Izzard suddenly because one step at a time. You know, this is one of my comedy heroes when I was a kid. So you've got to
– Yeah, she's amazing, man.
And that – so it was a sort of a step at a time, and it's still a step at a time. You know, I was meant to go to Edinburgh. Of course, it's frustrating. Lawyer's been going to Edinburgh for like 5 years now.
Yeah, I know Skulk's also been going for a couple of years.
Exactly, yeah.
That's also a thing I think people don't realize about this comedy thing is that it's actually such a long fucking journey. I mean, I know Louis C.K. is controversial for being a fucking pervert, but he was someone who only found his voice like later on when it came to comedy. Like he'll tell you it was like in his late 30s, I think, or even in his early 40s that he became Louis C.K. So do you ever think you're still finding your voice?
Yeah.
Ironically enough.
Very much so, hey, Bob. Yeah, he's hilariously. That actually could be a show. It's a good name for a ventriloquist show, Finding My Voice. Because that's eventually the show has to be about your own narrative. So for example, the show on racism, I keep calling that show because the show's name changes all the time. We're going to call it White Noise in London. In Edinburgh, and it was called How to End Racism by Chester Missing, like as a joke. Like, obviously, I'm not going to end fucking racism as a white guy. It's fucking preposterous. But so, you know, you, especially when it's about being able to find your voice, is also about having an audience that will listen to your voice so that you can say whatever thought comes out your head and they go with you and get it. I mean, I'm most like that when I'm doing a show for like an NGO, like people who know exactly what's in the news and understand our social politics entirely. Then whatever I think is what works, versus a lot of the time I have to go with the second or third thought because this is not exactly my core audience, which is fine. It's just that what Louis C.K. is describing is definitely something I'm working towards. And that's why it took a while to go to, I mean, I remember standing on stage in Montreal and like, you guys don't know anything about Africa. You don't know anything about race because it's Montreal. There's like three black people. You are very liberal, but in your kind of French Canadian way, and learning how to talk in the white liberal way. It's taken an arc. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, nicer in a lot of ways than our, like, than with love to white South Africans, but very, very liberal, very like people who were on the right side of history. I mean, Canada's an amazing place. They're a very aware country, but with problems.
Yeah, no, they've obviously, there's reasons why there aren't that many people of color in Canada I guess we won't really get into here. I think, yeah, man, that does bring us to the end here. I feel like I'll hit you up again probably in a year or two just to carry on with this conversation, because I feel like I could talk to you about your career forever, because it is one that I found quite fascinating, the lane that you've taken and how also that, you know, you're the stuff that you're interested in, and like that you, like you say, like you are a bit of a weirdo and a bit of a creep, and you've managed to make all these things turn into a very real comedy career. And you're, like you say, probably on your website, it says, you know, it's Africa's top ventriloquist and probably the only one. So yeah,
that,
man,
that needs to change, because there's a younger cat that come in. I need to change that. I'm just gonna check my website. Thanks Bob, I always love talking to you, and I've got to tell you something, mates. Back when Gareth Cliff's people were trolling the hell out of me back in the day, I always found your support and your courage very inspiring. So just so you know, I have a huge respect for you.
Oh, I appreciate that, man. I feel like having nothing to lose and just making sure you never have anything to lose allows you to be able to say anything you want. I feel sorry for all you guys with careers, you know, that you got to worry about your career ending. Me, I don't have that stress. It's like eventually,
I love it,
through doing all these things, like that. I mean, it's both good and bad, you know. Like I feel like I'm uncancelable because I've got nothing, like, and I keep trying to get canceled. Yeah. Like that's been my theory lately. Is like if I get canceled, I can just have a career. Like that's all I need for my career to take off, is just for one person to be like, Bob Perfect said this thing, and then like that to get picked up in the media, and all of a sudden people know who I am, and I can, I can do this thing. But yeah, it doesn't work if you're actually someone who has shame, I guess.
Yeah, that's the problem. But the truth is that I think you're on the right path. What you're doing is a way to find something interesting to say.
Yeah, shut, bro. I really do appreciate that. I mean, I've got such weird conflicts when it comes to South African comedy and when it comes to the industry and the scene, and I'm forever causing issues for myself when it comes to being booked and when it comes to performing and stuff. But like knowing that guys like you and a lot of other people who I respect, you know, also have respect for me, is something that genuinely does like motivate me a lot. So yeah, I really do appreciate that, bro.
Cool, bro.